This is Dr. Leslie Allen in his teaching on the Book of Lamentations. This is session number 6, Lamentations chapter 3, verses 1 through 16.
We come now to chapter 3 of Lamentations. We are only going to be studying verses 1 through 16 at this stage, but it's helpful to glance over the chapter as a whole and examine its complexity in terms of its different parts. I take verses 1 through 16 as a testimony from the mentor. And he reports a guilt-related prayer lament, an individual lament that he himself had prayed on an earlier occasion. And then in verses 17 through 24, he carries on by personally reflecting on that lament he just repeated, lessons he'd learned. He gives the lessons he learned, and especially he speaks in terms of hope. Then in 25 to 49, he moves into what we might call a sermon. He gives general theological teaching that integrates bad experience on the one hand and an expectation of good on the other. He moves on in 40 through 41 to a call to the congregation for penitential prayer that they need to engage in. Then in 42 through 47, he offers a model prayer for their suggestion, that they the sort of prayer that they could give themselves. Moving towards the end in 48 to 51, he supplies his personal emotional reactions of empathy with the congregation who are suffering. Then finally in 52 through 66, he gives another testimony, now a grievance-based testimony, another individual prayer lament, but based on grievance, but very much including hope. And so that's a run-through of chapter 3, and we shall only be looking at verses 1 through 16 at this particular stage. But we must think more generally about Lamentations 3, as we approach it. It's traditionally the most important chapter because of its central section that majors in hope, where it looks beyond tragedy in a positive way. In popular thinking, this section is the only part of value in the whole book for the Christian, and it can be condensed into one quotation about God, "Great is thy faithfulness," which is led to making of a beloved hymn, which we should be talking about. And so there tends to be a narrowing down of Lamentations, which nods to chapter 3, but only takes seriously a small part in the middle of chapter 3. When we turn to contemporary academic thinking about chapter 3, scholars want to think more broadly about Lamentations and the role of chapter 3 in it, which sounds right. They frequently use, in a negative way, the word privilege. We mustn't privilege chapter 3 over the rest of Lamentations. And sometimes the claim is made by scholars that chapter 3 was written later than the rest of the book, because it deviates from the other chapters, and so we can ignore it as not the original part of the book. And sometimes the point is made that there's contradiction in chapter 3. It talks of positive hope, yes, in chapter 3, but that's cancelled out by the closing lament with its focus on human conflict and distress. So there are ups and downs in chapter 3, and we must not privilege the ups and ignore the downs. And above all, we must not engage in chapter 3 and ignore the rest of the book. Because we must bear in mind that chapter 4 returns to suffering, big time, suffering again. And so there's no slick answer to the problem of grief in Lamentations. One must keep working through its processes, the process of grief, over and over again before one is done with it. And chapter 3 is by no means the end of the book. Well, where do I stand in this debate? I would want to make the point that chapter 3 wants to privilege itself. There's a self-privileging element in chapter 3. What's that? Well, the acrostic takes a special form. Remember the acrostic form that I mentioned? It features in chapters 1 and 2 and 3 and 4, and it goes through all the letters of the alphabet, Aleph, Beth, Gimel, Daleth, all the way through the 22 letters of the alphabet. Well, there's a new versification acknowledges this difference. Now we have 66 verses instead of 22. So we might say, is chapter 3 three times as long as chapters 1 or chapter 1 or chapter 2? Well, no. If you look at the space it takes up in the Bible, it doesn't seem to be any longer than chapter 1 or chapter 2. But what this new versification means is that it wants to acknowledge a new acrostic form. Hitherto, we've been thinking in terms of stanzas, 22 stanzas, three-line stanzas. But in chapter 1, there's one four-line stanza, and I didn't mention it, but in chapter 2, there's another four-line stanza. So in terms of lines, there are 67 lines in chapter 1 and 67 in chapter 2. Well, now, the difference in the acrostic is that it doesn't only deal with the beginning of stanzas, which was how the verses were reckoned in chapters 1 and 2, but it does so in terms of lines. Each stanza repeats that initial letter. And so it's like A in the first in the lines of the first three stanza, B in the lines of the second stanza, and so on. And so there's an intensified acrostic, and the new versification wants to do justice to that. It's marching along in terms of the acrostic form. And so this is very special. And chapter 3 is demarcated as very special by this intensification of the acrostic. And we've got to take that seriously. And we must ask again, as we did before, what does it mean? What does it mean? Is it just an interesting way of composing poems? No, it must be more than that. And I was urging before that it refers to totality. And in chapters 1 and 2, and again in chapter 4, it's going to refer to the totality of suffering and an itemized totality in those chapters. But chapter 3 wants to go further. It embraces disaster and distress, but it goes beyond it to new and positive prospects. And so it enlarges the totality. Grief can come to an end, hopefully, and it points to hope as the way beyond grief. And so we must take seriously what's being done here. Who is the speaker in chapter 3? Zion no longer speaks. There's no longer a woman speaker anymore, and not in the rest of the book. In fact, she said her last word in chapter 2 and verse 22. So who is speaking? I follow a minority view, an admittedly minority view, and I take the main speaker in chapters 1 and 2 as still carrying on in chapter 3. And I want to identify him, as you know, with a mentor, the one who is guiding the people through their suffering. And here in this chapter, daring them to look beyond the suffering to a possibility, a theological possibility that can well be theirs. Is there any objective evidence for seeing the main speaker here, that mentor here, the one I identify as a mentor? Well, yes, there is. In 49 to 51 of chapter 3, he speaks in a very definite way that is reminiscent of something in chapter 2. 3:49, my eyes will flow without ceasing, without respite, until the Lord from heaven looks down and sees. My eyes cause me grief at the fate of all the young women in my city. And this is a reaction, a personal reaction to the distress of the fall of Jerusalem. And this sounds remarkably like what the speaker had said back in 2:11. My eyes are spent with weeping, my stomach churns, my bile is poured out on the ground because of the destruction of my people, because infants and babes faint in the streets of the city. And so that similarity, I think, lends more than possibility to the notion that the main speaker in the first two chapters, in fact, the mentor in my way of thinking, is carrying on speaking further. I think there's more evidence than that. In verse 1 of chapter 3, and in the new RSV, it reads, I am the one who has seen affliction. And we'll just stay there. If we look at the New International Version, there's a different rendering there, and we need to notice what the difference is and why. It says, I am the man who has seen affliction. And yes, it can well mean that. The Hebrew word here literally means man. And if we look in the Hebrew lexicon, as to the range of this word, yes, it's a man in terms of a male, but it can also be used as a person, any human being, a person rather than just a male person. And there's linguistic warrant for the use of that word in the Hebrew Bible. And the new RSV, as part of its inclusive program, takes it in that way. I am one who has seen affliction. And yes, it could mean that. But what happens if we take it as a male person? And the NIV, which also engages in an inclusive program, it does want to keep the male reference here. I am the man who has seen affliction. And I think this fits in very well, because we've just had a woman who has seen affliction. We have had Zion taking part in that dramatic liturgy, representing Zion and speaking of her sorrows. And I've claimed that she's been acting as a female role model. Well, now we have a male role model. And that mentor puts himself in the limelight for a while in these first verses in 1 to 16 and gives a personal testimony, an individual lament of his own, thinking back to when he prayed to God and what that prayer consisted of. And so not only was Zion told to pray, but now the mentor, the male counterpart of Zion, is bringing his own prayer, or more strictly, a report of his own prayer. Of course, if it were an actual prayer lament, then it would more naturally be addressed to God as you and your. But this is a report that the mentor gives, and so God is spoken of in the third person. There's a translation into the third person in this individual lament of verses 1 through 16. Now here I want to introduce a notion which I haven't seen elsewhere in any other commentary, the notion of the wounded healer which I think is very valuable in our study of Lamentations, and especially Lamentations 3. The concept of the wounded healer very much features in psychology, and it was brought to the fore by the psychiatrist Carl Jung. And Carl Jung was depending on a very ancient tradition. In Greek mythology, there was a physician, a very good physician, a very clever physician, and he could resuscitate dead people, and he was well known for that. But he angered the gods, and the gods claimed life and death is our prerogative. How dare you usurp our prerogative? And so they wounded him. They wounded him, this physician. Now, it was picked up by Carl Jung in two ways. And he said, the therapist can be a wounded healer in two quite distinct ways. First of all, the therapist can be wounded by listening to the patient's suffering and find it overwhelming in turn, so that at the end of the session, he is left worried, he is left grieving in turn. And that is a real worry. In the work I've done as chaplain over the years, I've found occasions when I've been overwhelmed by the stories that patients have told me. And I've gone away, and I cannot just go into another patient's room and start again listening to them. I've got to rest a while. Perhaps I can go back to the pastoral care office and type out a report, and that will help. Or perhaps I need to debrief and turn to another chaplain and say, I did find that overwhelming, and telling the story will ease that burden that's resting upon me. And so the healer can be wounded in turn. That is very much a reality. And this seems to be what's happening here in Lamentations 3, in 49 through 51, that the healer himself, the would-be healer under God, is wounded in turn, and he is weeping in turn at this social catastrophe. But then, too, we can also look back to verse 11. Of chapter 2, my eyes are spent with weeping because of the destruction of my people. And verse 13, vast as the sea is your ruin, with what can I compare you? And there too, in both those passages, in 2 and 3, there's this wounding of the healer. He doesn't escape unscathed by this trouble, and he has compassion for my people. But he's overwhelmed in turn. But Carl Jung had another application of this notion of the wounded healer, and that is someone who is wounded can become a healer and become a good healer because he has been wounded. And I think this is coming out in the testimonies at the beginning of chapter 3 and the end of chapter 3, that the mentor refers to his own wounding in previous days, apart from the destruction of the city. There were bad scenes that he went through, which took a lot of getting over, and he tells the congregation about that. And so he's claiming, in trying to heal you, I am a wounded healer. And this reminds me of Alcoholics Anonymous, because they have very much a principle, it takes an alcoholic to help an alcoholic. And in their great little book on the 12 steps, you find quotations such as this: showing others who suffer how we were given help is the very thing that makes life so worthwhile to us now. Having been wounded, we can turn to healing others. And then, in God's hands, the dark past is the greatest possession you have, the key to life and happiness for others. And so the recovering alcoholic, the ex-alcoholic, has within him or her the capacity to help others through. And so the suffering is not wasted, but it can be part of a pastoral learning experience that can say to others, I've been in some respects where you are, and you can trust me to help you through. And this creates an affinity, a rapport. And so it is that we have these laments at beginning and end. And their value is of testimonies to his own suffering. I've been there. I've been there. And so it means that we do need all the way through past tenses. The NRSV has got perfect tenses. He has done something, but really it's he drove and brought me into darkness in verse 2 and so on. It's referring to a past experience, which is his no longer. And in the commentary I wrote on Lamentations, a liturgy of grief, this is something that I had to say on the subject of the wounded healer in chapter 3. In this poem, a wounded healer offers his knowledge of God's ways and his experience of them in a context of suffering. At beginning and end, he ministers out of his own suffering and presents himself as an object lesson. As a fellow sufferer, he points the congregation forward to a new wholeness that both he and they yearn to attain. In turn, we readers who are wounded have the potential to be wounded healers. The scar from our wound, though it may still ache, will provide relief for the raw pain of others. In this testimony, in verses 1 to 16, we have a variety of metaphors. And first of all, we need to say that some laments do very much engage in metaphor. And they're useful as generalizations of suffering. You don't find specific references to suffering in the Psalms of Lament. And nobody ever says, I have a bad case of pneumonia that I need healing from God. But it's quite general. And so metaphorical language, picture language, is very useful to be a way of referring to all different types of suffering. What is the significance of metaphor? Well, C.S. Lewis wrote an essay on metaphor, and he suggested that metaphor belongs to the world of the imagination. The imagination involved in metaphor helps us to understand the reality behind the metaphor. And that understanding doesn't concern truth, but it concerns meaning. It doesn't concern truth, which is the opposite of falsehood, but it concerns meaning, which is the opposite of nonsense. Reason is the organ of truth. Imagination is the organization of meaning. Metaphor in the Psalms, and not just a psalm laments, is concerned with valid meaning and experiencing reality. Through metaphor, the psalmist's intent is to share their experiences. They want our eyes to light up as we read these imaginative metaphors vividly describe their experiences. They want us to say, yes, that's just what it's like. I can see it now. And metaphors enable that in the Psalms. And so likewise, here in this testimony reporting a prayer lament, we have a mass of different pictures, a mass of imaginative snapshots. There's more I want to say about metaphor, but this will do, and we will look through them individually, and then we'll come back to the more generally to the significance of metaphor in this particular place. We need to ask what the tone of this testimony is. There are a number of commentators who see accusation here. God is cruel. God is a despot. God is a bully. And we might say, well, why not? Why not? Well, it does speak of wrath. I am the one who has seen affliction, says verse 1, under the rod of God's wrath. And this is not the first time we've had this word. And so we have to ask again what that wrath is. And usually in the Old Testament and in the New, it's a reaction to human wrongdoing. Occasionally, it's regarded as inexplicable and amoral. There's a use in Psalm 102 where there's no reference to sinning in the context where we perhaps should take it in that way, but not very often. And if we take chapter 3 as belonging firmly to the book, well, here it occurs after chapters 1 and 2. And chapter 1 had an emphasis on Zion's sinning, and chapter 2 went further to speak of God's wrath as the reaction to that sinning. And so chapter 3 seems to carry on from chapter 2 and to presuppose it. And in fact, the NRSV is right. Though it translates under the rod of God's wrath, it says in the footnote, literally his, Hebrew has his. So there's a leaning back to the wrath of God in chapter 2, which has been associated with Zion's wrongdoing. And so here we are in this testimony. There are these references to God in this hostile way. And we need to ask, well, do the Psalms speak like this? We've mentioned in chapter 2, there was a dependence on prophetic usage, where God prophesied, I am going to do harm to the people of Israel, this negative intervention in those oracles of disaster. But how about the Psalms? Does it fit into a psalm lament? Yes, it does. Because we do sometimes have reference to God's negative intervention in psalm laments and in psalm thanksgivings that confess sin. Psalm 32, for day and night your hand was heavy upon me. Verse 38, verses 1 and 2. Psalm 38, verses 1 and 2. O Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger or discipline me in your wrath, for your arrows have sunk into me and your hand has come down on me. Psalm 39, verse 10. Remove your stroke from me. I am worn down by the blows of your hand. Verse 51. Psalm 51, verse 8. Let the bones you have crushed rejoice. And so this is a sampling from the Psalms, and there are other Psalms too that want to speak in this negative way about God. God punishing the individual psalmist, and the psalmist speaking of it. And here this is very much echoed, and so it's in line with certain numbers of the psalm laments. And so the psalmist, and here the mentor who's speaking as a psalmist, he's speaking of extreme suffering that he's been undergoing. And he does so in a whole series of imaginative ways, metaphorical ways. Verse 1, it's a blow from a stick, the rod of God's wrath. And that's like verse 3, where it's a blow from God's hand. Verse 2 speaks of darkness, being God driving into darkness. And that's always a powerful, sinister metaphor. And then in verse 4, it speaks of sickness as being sent by God, and even fractures. He's broken my bones. Verse 5, in a different type of metaphor, it speaks of a siege. You besieged me. He's besieged and enveloped me with bitterness and tribulation. Verse 6, made me sit in darkness like the dead of long ago. Yes, darkness, as in verse 2, but now it's associated with death. But here it's not literal death. It's a low quality of life when you feel it as good as dead. And a number of psalms speak metaphorically about death as a low quality of life. And the dead of long ago are those long long dead with no hope of living again. Verse 7 speaks of being imprisoned. He has walled me about so that I cannot escape. And even worse, he's put heavy chains on me. So he can't move. He's locked up and confined, no freedom to move. And that's very much a theme of the Psalms. And it comes out in the Hebrew very often in ways that our English translations don't accurately translate. There's the word translated distress or trouble, zara. It's literally narrowness, being in a narrow place, being confined, being shut in a closet. And trouble is narrowness, and you can't move. And then opposite that is being brought into a broad place, being brought into a place of freedom. And there are psalms that speak in this way. Psalm 18 does, for instance. Let me get the reference. Yes, Psalm 18 and verse 19. He brought me out into a broad place. He delivered me because he delighted me. And this is the opposite, being brought out into a broad place. And then in Psalm 118 verse 5, they're the two sides of this. Out of my distress, and it uses not zara, but the same root, metzar. Out of my distress, out of my narrowness, I called on the Lord. The Lord answered me and set me in a broad place. And so there's this sense of being confined and hemmed in, and over against that, the broad place, being able to develop. Free at last, I can do as I need to do and as I want to do. And this is a great contrast that we find in the Psalms here and there. And then it moves on to this verse 8 is a factual experience, not a metaphorical one. Though I call and cry for help, he shuts out my prayer. There's no understanding as to why the prayer shouldn't be answered. And that, too, is something that often occurs in the Psalms. And the blocking of the way, another sort of confinement in verse 9, he's blocked my ways with hewn stones, and I can't move forward. And there's obstruction. He's made my paths crooked. No straight way forward. And instead of life being an ongoing straight journey, one has to twist and turn to find a possible way through. And then verse 10, as often in the Psalms, we find illustration of wild animals. Often human enemies are portrayed as wild animals in the Psalms. And here God is like a wild animal. He's a bear lying in wait for me, a lion in hiding. He led me off my way and tore me in pieces. He's made me desolate. And then he bent his bow and set me as a mark for his arrow. And in both cases here, there's the thought of a preparation for this bad thing, and then doing it. And so the bear lying in wait, the lion hiding, and then the pouncing and tearing, being torn in pieces. And then the archer bending his bow and carefully aiming, and then the arrow goes forward and shoots him. And so in verse 13, he shot into my vitals, literally kidneys, the arrows of his quiver. And then in 14, he comes to secondary suffering as a result of all this. I've become the laughingstock of all my people. And this, of course, shows it's an individual lament here. And there were people around him, his own people, who were ridiculing him and mocking him. The object of their taunt songs all day long. And so that, too, is a factual experience. And then he's filled me with bitterness. He's sated me with wormwood. Wormwood is actually Artemisia, which is a lovely group of flowers and shrubs, but the leaves are very bitter, and you wouldn't want to munch on a leaf, an Artemisia leaf. It was called Wormwood in English, because it was a herbal treatment for worms in the intestines, and so wood for worms to deal with worms, and so it had a positive value. But in the ancient world, it was just bitter, and you wouldn't want to eat it at all. And so here we are. There are all these painful experiences. And then verse 16, he's made my teeth grind on gravel. He knocked me to the ground, made me bite the dust, as it were. He made me cower in ashes. And so there we are. We've got all these metaphors, very vivid, and you can't help listening to them. On and on, different amassing of metaphors. They're dramatic. They're even sensational. And we might want to ask, what's the special purpose in this context? Well, I think the congregation would listen to every word. It's so sensational, all this different way of speaking, this piling up of metaphors. And I think that's intentional, because the mentor wants the congregation to listen. And when I was preparing my commentary on Lamentations, I read any number of books on suffering, technical books, and also autobiographies, books, and collections of essays. And one essay I read was written by a pastor who had the difficult task of officiating at his son's funeral. And this is how he began. I have been where life hurts the most and cuts the deepest and hits the hardest. Therefore, listen to me. And I think that's a fine summary of the intention of these first 16 verses of chapter 3. And the congregation are meant to listen to his own suffering and his own explanation of suffering and take it to their own hearts and to embrace in their own understanding this theological phenomenon of God no longer the friend, but God as the enemy. This is the starting point that they must reach. Their expectations of always the love of God, no, that hadn't happened, and they have to deal with that situation. But there is a way of dealing with it. And so they can listen to this man who has thought it through in his own experience, has experienced such a thing himself, who has himself suffered at God's hands, and so he's well qualified to be their mentor. And his interpretation of his own suffering as providential would encourage them to accept his earlier interpretation of their suffering as right and worth taking seriously. And at this point, I need to say that the purpose of chapter 3 is to pave the way for the mentor's call for them to pray a prayer of repentance, such as verses 40 to 47 will urge them to do, and to confess their own sinfulness on the lines of verse 44 that we shall come to. And certainly, this testimony in 1 to 16, it certainly prepares the way for that praying in a clear way. It's a prayer of lament that basically presupposes the mentor's own guilt that deserves the wrath of God and deserves that negative intervention from God. And so this is his starting point, but by no means the way he's going to finish. But he's going to use it as the rational basis for moving on and moving beyond what he's just said.
Thank you. This is Dr. Leslie Allen in his teaching on the Book of Lamentations. This is session number 6, Lamentations chapter 3, verses 1 through 16.